This podcast is a collaboration between Costard and Touchstone Productions and the Dads from the Crypt podcast.
Basically, this ride is like a large circle that you get on and it starts spinning and then the floor drops out and you're pinned to the wall because it's centripetal force. So you're just floating over air. It's like a centrifuge for white trash. So I go on this with my dad and the floor has these like big steel girders with like Frankenstein neck bolts in them. And so what my dad doesn't notice is that his pants get caught on one of the bolts. So the floor starts going, the ride starts going, the floor drops out, and his pants just tear off. Like a Chippendale dancer, just gone. Yeah.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the How Not to Make a Movie podcast. I'm Alan Katz. Gil will join us momentarily. First, hey, we're feeling our inner Beyonce here. If you like it, you don't even have to put a ring on it. Just hitting like will do. Better yet, subscribe. That way, you'll be ahead of the curve on everything else we're working on, like our new streaming horror black comedy TV series. Are You Afraid? Here's a preview.
Flesh-eating ghouls.
For a long time, we humans have been deeply afraid of vampires and zombies.
10, 4 paramedics.
Fair enough. Vampires and zombies are scary. But neither vampires nor zombies
are real.
Flesh-eating ghouls, on the other hand, are real.
They've been living in our shadow for thousands of years, hunting us, feasting on us, treating us
like food.
But some ghouls are tired of living in the shadow of their food. Those ghouls have decided it's time to leave the shadow
and put us in our place where we belong.
On the menu.
It's an eat or be eaten world.
Flavored by fear, filled with the monster we
should have been afraid of all along.
Flesh-eating ghouls.
Are You Afraid?
You better be.
Coming soon.
We first met comedian and podcast host Ken Reed when he very kindly invited us onto his podcast, The Terrific TV Guidance Counselor. In addition to being a longtime podcaster, Ken's a Boston-based stand-up and a fantastic storyteller. His approach to comedy is via story rather than joke, and that, I suspect, is where our minds all come together. You know, Gil and I have done a fair number of podcasts. We talk to people every week, same as Ken. But I don't know, when we first sat down and talked to Ken on his podcast, something sparked. We really liked talking to him. So it was natural to return the favor and have Ken on our podcast. But wouldn't you know it, that same spark showed up again. What can I tell you? We just love talking to this guy, and the conversation feels like it. In this one, we talk a lot about comedy, what makes things funny, how to convey funny, how to be funny. What does it even mean to have a sense of humor? And does everyone have one? The answer may not be yes, as you'll see. With plenty of laughs along the way, being funny is some serious shit. And Ken Reed is a stand-up guy in every way there is.
One of the things, you're a terrific stand-up.
Oh, thank you.
There's some of your stuff going back, you know, what I was able to find. You're awfully funny. Your approach to comedy is via story, not via jokes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it was easier for me to, so I started when I lived in the UK, which is funny, as I say, I started in London, but in hindsight, I probably did it 10 times there, but that's kind of where I started. So I couldn't really use like pop culture references or that kind of stuff. So that shorthand was gone, and I can't memorize things. Like, I've never written jokes down that I do. I just am terrible at memorization. Mm-hmm. So it's way easier for me to remember a story.
But yeah, when I first came to town, one of my early mentors when I was still living back east was a guy who insisted that when I got out to LA that I do stand up. And I contemplated that when I first got to LA, I was part of a Sunday afternoon pickup. So,
where's my microphone? Jesus, what an idiot! Oh my God, I just I just I saw your face and I launched right into
it's
it.
It's quite all right. No, it's fine.
When I was, I apologize, audience, for the fact that you couldn't hear me, or maybe that was your good fortune. You couldn't hear me through the early part of this. Anyway, when I first got to LA, I was part of a Sunday afternoon pickup game of stand-ups. And among the people who played in that, this is in the mid-1980s, Jerry Seinfeld played in that, Tom Arnold played in that, a lot of guys who did the circuits here and all around the country. Every single one of them did Vin Scully. So at any particular time, at any particular point in the action, there were five, six, or seven Vin Scullys calling the action.
Right, and all wanting you to pay attention to them.
Of your softball game. It was maddening. But anyway, so yeah, I was always tight with stand-ups. I could never do what you do. It terrifies the fuck out of me.
Really? See, to me, so I was in bands before that, so I was kind of used to being on stage, but it's really freeing because, and I say this when younger stand-ups ask me about stand-up, which I wouldn't recommend to them, but I always say, you know, unless you're like exceptionally terrible, like the worst they've ever seen, or one of the best they've ever seen, they're not going to remember your set. They won't remember your name. Like, and that's kind of freeing. Like, they're not filming it. You can get up there and say whatever you want, and then it's gone, you know. And there's very few things that, even especially now, there are very few things that sort of fit into that category.
What are the best things I did when I got to LA? Well, first best thing was I met Gil. That was the first best thing. Second best
I must say, when you first walked into my office, I did remember you doing some stand-up and wondering, is this guy delivering sandwiches or what's he doing?
Well, it was shtick, you know, shtick. You know, call it what you will. I took a couple of classes with the Groundlings, and learning improv was terrific. The first class I took was great, and I think I did well in it, but the second class was not as successful for me, and it was my fault. The teacher pointed out to me that my problem was that I had started writing. I wasn't
second-guessing everything.
I wasn't in the moment anymore. Now I was trying to compose, to make something happen, to get to a punchline. No. Can I work that way? And so something in me just lost confidence, I guess, in the moment. And that's really where I think your qualities as a storyteller, and you're a terrific storyteller.
Oh, thank you.
The stories are really terrific, but you're great in the moment in really reading the room and then writing the room as necessary. It's lovely. It's always lovely to watch great craft.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah. It's that's the other thing I like too, is you can adjust in the moment, which again, is really hard to do in almost anything else, where, you know, if the audience, you know, you can kind of manipulate the audience, and it's, you know, people are always like, oh, you really want the laughter and stuff. And it sounds evil when I say this. I'm like, no, I like a room full of strangers, and I sort of walk them down a path and make them react the way I want to react them to react. It happens to be a laugh, but like the fact that you're able, that's the kind of exciting part. And being able to change it in the moment, which, you know, if you're doing a song or something else, like midway through, you can't change it if you need to. And it doesn't always work, but like, it's kind of freeing to have that option.
Ken tells a great story from his youth about he and his dad finding an elderly neighbor dead in his house.
Now, his arm was up above his head and was completely stripped of any flesh. It was just bone. It looked like a cartoon when a cat has a whole fish they put in their mouth and pull it out clean. It was like that. Now, keep in mind, I had seen every horror movie ever. So the first thing that occurred to me was, that's not very convincing. Like, I really thought, I was like, Tom Savini would not let that out of the shop. That is no way that would have, I mean, maybe put some KY on
what
it.
What happened to him, and your reaction to what happened to him, is a terrific story. It's really very, very well told, and it comes around in lovely, lovely ways. It's it's beautifully composed. And while you don't write jokes, surely you composed that in some way. Is it in any way on paper? Or is it simply really like a moth story?
Sort of, yeah. I've always been like a big reader, and I was really into comics growing up and still am, but that was like, I never slept. I would just read. I remember a friend in high school said, you know, I'd come over your house and you would literally have headphones on listening to music, would be reading a book and watching a movie with the subtitles on. And I'm like, oh yeah, I guess I did do that. So
how old were you at that point?
Oh, probably 13, 14, somewhere around there.
So you are, I don't think that ever really goes away. The inside of your head, I imagine, is kind of like mine's like a black box theater turned upside down.
Yeah.
And there are a thousand things going on at the same time.
Yeah, exactly.
So you are hypomanic. Have you been diagnosed?
No.
If you haven't been, I just diagnosed.
You just did. Excellent. No copay necessary. So I kind of, you know, inadvertently learned story structure. Like what, by just like, why did I like this? Like I liked reverse engineering stuff.
Let's stay here in your youth.
Sure.
You were a creative, obviously. That was a fact of your life. When do you know you were a creative? You weren't just an oddball, I'm a creative.
I don't know if I do now. No, that was probably my teens. So because that was when I first was able to do stuff. As a kid, I always drew, and I like, you know, I used to like to do film criticism as a kid. And it was funny, a few years ago, I ran into an old neighbor who I hadn't seen in like 30 years. And she was like, my dad, we were just talking about you the other day. We were talking about how in elementary school, I would stop at their house and pick them up and walk to school with them. And she goes, and you'd get there early and you would read the paper and tell jokes about the current events in the morning. And I was like, I don't recall that, but that sounds about right. So probably then, but I got really into punk rock. So that was like eye-opening to me, because growing up just outside of Boston, we had really amazing college radio. And if I had been one town further north, I would not have been able to get it. And so I got exposed to all these bands, and I would literally sit with a notepad and write down stuff I liked and hunt them down. And that sort of like DIY.
Who did you love?
The Damned are probably one of my favorite bands of all time. And I saw them on The Young Ones when MTV used to air The Young Ones.
Back to back
with the Monkees. And I was like, that I cite that as kind of like my inciting incident and like what I am today, because I was 5 or 6 years old. I had horrible insomnia. I never slept. So I just watched TV all night, and I saw Dave Vanian of The Damned dressed as a vampire playing punk rock and The Young Ones. And I was like, I don't know what this is, but it's everything I love in the world. Like I just realized what it's. And so I'd see like Another State of Mind, and there was a show on USA Network called Night Flight. And that's where I, learned about John Waters and all that kind of stuff. So I started kind of realizing that some of this stuff was attainable. And I was lucky enough that John Waters, who I kind of say is the first person I ever saw do stand up in person, because he wouldn't say he does stand up, but he does these spoken word tours. And because he lived in P-Town on the Cape, but you know, half the year, at least once or twice a year when I was growing up, he would do a screening and do a Q&A, and I would go. Wow. And it was amazing because he's so well-educated in film history and a true fan, but also just has these amazing stories and like insane stories that would come out of questions people asked. So they weren't like he necessarily had prepared them in advance, but clearly they were like well-structured, thought out, like perfect stories.
Sure.
And so that was another piece that sort of fit in there. So
understood. So you understood the cataloging of one's stories.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, sure.
Exactly.
And you certainly took that from a master.
Oh yeah. I mean, he's amazing at it. Like just so good at it. It makes it seem just effortless. And that's like the thing about stand-up is if someone's really good at it, it looks like they're not doing anything and you could do it. And if someone's really bad at it, it looks like you could do it. So it's like a weird thing where it goes full circle. And then when I was about 13, I was like the height I am now and the sideburn level I am now. And I used to get into all the clubs and bars in Boston. Like, no one would check my ID. I've never drank in my life, so I would never cause a problem. So I would go to all these punk rock clubs like The Rat and the Middle East, and I would just sit and watch bands play. So around 15, we started a band, and we were playing out every week. And right place, right time, we started with like the band The Dropkick Murphys, who are huge from The Departed. And I mean, those were the guys that we started with, and we're 15, 16, and we're playing with like the Mighty Mighty Boston, and all of a sudden we're playing on these shows. So that's when I was like, oh, you can do a thing. And it was weird, because I realized that, you know, I was paying for like a separate phone line, and I was like talking to managers and booking tours, and I'm like 16, 17.
Nobody bothered to tell you that, dude, you can't do any of this shit. It's right. It's by the time anyone would have had the sense to tell you, what are you doing, it was too late.
Yeah, we were doing, I mean, it was, you know, we were driving down to New York and driving home on a Saturday, and my parents were semi-absent, so they were like, he's not on fire. So as long as that's not the case, everything's fine.
You tell a funny bit about your parents being, on the one hand, lovely and permissive in that way, and yet on the other hand, well, okay, permissive to an extreme?
Yes, yeah, yeah. I mean, my mother was convinced my favorite movie was Charles Kaufman's Mother's Day. Which is a pretty rough film. I've never seen that. And would rent it for me and just like sit me down and rent this movie. And, you know, they would take me to the movies at see every R-rated thing, cause they want to get a babysitter. But, my mom would drop me at my grandfather's house a lot. My grandfather was this giant sort of angry, depressed man from Norway. And when I would be over his house, he would sit in at the kitchen table in the dark, in a wife beater and his dress pants and smoke. And there was like a stained smoke ring above him on the kitchen table. And he would just sit there and not talk or anything. And so she rented, you know, she'd just grab a stack of like horror movies and sit me in the living room until she got back. So The Exorcist was one of them. And I was probably 6. And the scene you imagine would be the scene that would be the final straw for a Norwegian man born in the 30s and grew up Catholic. Happens, and he comes in, he doesn't press eject because I don't think he's ever used the VCR, and he just shoves his hand into the VCR and ripped the tape out and smashes it on the wall, and then just went back into the kitchen and lit up a cigarette. And my mom had to pay like $129 for the tape, but yeah, that was sort of the environment at the time.
Wow. Hey, out of such intense pressure come diamonds.
Yes, exactly.
Apparently. So all right, so certainly we you see where all the influences came from. Where comedy was concerned, were there particular influences where, okay, yeah, that's really funny. Yeah, that's kind of fucking lame.
Yeah. Yeah, it was definitely like I loved Bob Newhart. Bob Newhart, huge. And I'll be like, oh, a lot of my stuff I'm ripping off Bob Newhart. And people are like, what? I'm like, it just maybe it comes out sounding like this, but in my head, I'm ripping off Bob Newhart. And it's a lot of sitcoms. I love sitcoms. I still do. It's such a specific style of writing and a difficult, it's truly writer's medium for the most part compared to everything else, like multicam sitcom. And, you know, there's great ensemble cast, but the writing is exactly what it is. And Barney Miller's the one I always cite because that show is a play every week. It's 5 characters, 1 room, nothing happens. They're doing paperwork and it's funny and amazing. And so growing up, I recognized that I enjoyed that kind of humor.
I would throw in the word literate.
Yes, that's true. And I was like, oh, okay, so comedy is you have to wait for the right thing to happen and then say the funniest possible thing when it does. Because it didn't hit me that like there were writers or so. Some of that I realized doing stand-up later, I try to sort of reverse engineer on stage. And there's a writer for the Boston Globe, Nick Zeno, who was interviewing me for something for the Globe. And he said, you like to create, go on stage and create chaotic situations you can control. And I was like, yeah, actually, that's pretty accurate. So it was sort of trying to reverse engineer sitcom stuff. You know, loving Bob Newhart, loving the young ones. Like that blew my mind because it was silly and smart and weird and violent and dumb and smart at the same time.
I'm going to throw another word in, and anarchic.
Yes, 100%. Like anything could happen.
Look, this must be my bedroom. All my clothes are here. No, they're not, Vivian. Oh, I didn't have the bedroom.
And then the other big one was Dana Gould, who's become a good friend, which is insane to me. But he was one of the Boston stand-ups that definitely stood out because we had the Boston stand-up scene of the 80s and 90s. We had some amazing people like Stephen Wright and Kevin Meaney. And but, you know, there was a lot of the guys being like, the Chinese food weight is all like just like the worst possible thing. But Dana was one of those guys where he'd go on stage and he's talking about Morrissey and Planet of the Apes and really funny. And I learned that he was from here, and I'm like, oh, you can be from here and not be like the Red Sox and the fucking, and do something different. So that was a huge piece of it too.
You could talk about the rest of the world.
Yes, exactly.
As if you also came from there too.
Yeah. And John Waters, again, is the big one. Not even his films as much, which I do like, but like him.
Yeah, he grasped, well, he didn't grasp anything. That's just who he is. But branding.
Yeah, and he was a professional fan and to a degree. He was like the first person that I think people gave like Quentin Tarantino credit for later. But I was like, I'm not the biggest Tarantino fan, but I'm like, that's a guy, the best. I wouldn't say he has talent. I say he have good taste. Like, but like John Waters, like he could speak eloquently and at length about, you know, William Castle and, you know, he was reading the Catholic Review of Film in the 50s, you know, like just he knew what he was talking about, but also had a reverence for it and could also be a little bit, you know, step back and laugh at campy stuff and still appreciate it without being totally sarcastic or just crapping all over people's films.
One way to do it.
Yeah.
What happened in the UK that suddenly the stand-up button turned on?
Well, I always was sort of gravitated towards like the music and the movies and the comedy from over there that I could get here. And when I was 19, the band broke up. And I am not a musician. Like I was like, all right, well, I'm not doing that again.
What instrument were you supposedly playing?
I'm making air quotes for listener, singing. But at the same time, like, you know, my rudimentary guitar skills, like, there are songs we recorded that I wrote the whole thing, like,
but you were a punk band, right?
Yes. Yeah.
But that's the point. You're not supposed
it
to,
is.
You're not supposed to be,
it is
Mark Knopfler. You're the unmarked Knopfler.
Totally. But the other thing was like, I always held myself to a ridiculously high standard where I'm just like, I should be good at stuff. And I'm terrible at practicing things. I did like martial arts when I was a kid. I always loved magic, but I'm like, that's way too much practice. I can't do it. You know, other languages, that kind of stuff. But like musically, I'm like, as much as I love punk rock too, I'm like, wow, I really like The Cure and Nick Cave and Prince. Like, you know, like that's, I'm not going to do that stuff. I'm like an adamant fan. So I did an exchange program. The school that I went to did a thing where you could go to Goldsmiths College in London, which is where like Damien Hirst went, and actually the Sex Pistols met there, and Blur, and you'd still graduate from Northeastern. Like the credits were the same.
Sure.
So I did that and in 2001 and loved it. And
that was your junior year?
Yes. Yeah.
So it was a JYA.
Yes, exactly. Okay,
cool. Oh, yeah, I took mine in Paris. Which
yes, see, it's because you can. Yeah. So, and I loved it. I was like, and it was also me being sort of thrown into the deep end. I didn't know anyone there. I knew nothing. And I made a bunch of friends and it was great. Like, it was just really confidence building. And so then I spent the next year and a half trying to go back. So I transferred and I did my final semester there and graduated from there, and then had another, I think our visa was good for 6 months. So
you really enjoyed living in London.
I loved it. I loved it.
Yeah. It's a really special place, never mind to visit, but to live.
Yeah, absolutely. And I had, you know, I had no money in Boston. I had no money there, but it was, you know, every day I'd walk from New Cross to Greenwich and I'd get a sandwich and I'd, you know, look through the record stores. Like, it was just nice.
Where were you living in London?
I was in New Cross. So I was like right in South London next to like Lewisham and Deptford. And because where were you guys living when you were doing Tales?
Knightsbridge.
Oh, okay. A little more high end.
But, you know, when I first went to London, I did plays and I lived in Hampstead.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Near the Hampstead Theatre Club, because I was working at the Hampstead Theatre Club.
The Hampstead Heath area.
Yeah.
That's where Steve Jones from the Sex Pistols grew up there, and his autobiography is really fascinating. There's a lot of interesting stuff about like post-war Hampstead.
Yeah.
But it was just amazing. And so I ended up being able to go back and finish. And I was still not sleeping, and I always kind of wanted to try stand up. And in South London, in Greenwich, there was a place called Up the Creek, which was sort of like an alt-com comedy store kind of place. And Sunday nights, it was an open mic, but it was kind of like the kind of open mic they call Sacrificing Virgins, where it's pretty rough. And it was a real working class crowd.
Sacrificing Virgins. It sounds so inviting.
Yes. And also this was when the Iraq war had broken out. So they're like, you can't say you're American. We have to introduce you as Canadian. And which was true. And so, you know, it was a real trial by fire. And the interesting thing there was the hecklers would listen to what you were doing. And like their heckle would be very pointed, well-observed notes. So it was worse because they weren't just like, okay, shut up. It was like they would like improve on what you were doing. And so
your timing on that joke was really subpar. Right?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, right. You couldn't wait the extra beat, could you?
Yeah. So it was almost like a de facto. But part of, you know, I was used to playing punk rock shows. Like literally I'd been hit in the face with bricks at shows. And like, you know, like we were playing in abandoned buildings in Philadelphia.
Which was worse or better? I don't know. How do you compare that? Getting hit with a brick or getting hit with
barbed statement. It's tough. Yeah. They both sting. Probably the brick was easier because that eventually went away, that pain. So I started doing it there and, you know, and met a bunch of people at some of the open mics there. Like John Oliver was one of the guys who would do the open mic that I would go to. And then my visa ran out. I moved back and just started doing it here.
Is there a significant difference between their V here?
Yes. Because stand up is sort of the traditional stand up that we think of as uniquely American. Like it's kind of put in the category of like jazz and, you know, those things that are like, these are American arts. And that's like the sort of Carlin, Lenny Bruce, Richard Pryor stand-up. So in the UK, that never really made it over there. And until the early 80s, their prominent like live performance stand-up was working men's clubs, where it was like old white guys doing like racist street jokes, right? So they didn't have like the tradition we had, but as a result, they had this huge alt comedy sort of revolution, which was like Don French and Jennifer Saunders, the Young Ones people, Lexi Sale, and they all started doing this show at a strip club in Soho called the Comic Strip After Hours, and they ended up getting TV shows because Channel 4 started. So that became sort of the mainstream of comedy there in a lot of ways. And there's a guy named Vic Reeves, where it's Vic Reeves and Bob Mortimer, who had this really surreal two-man act that actually started at Goldsmiths. And when I moved there, they still are, but they were like huge TV stars. They had a sort of a fake game show, but the show was just so smart and weird and bizarre and stuff that experimental. And so that was kind of the mainstream there. People were still doing like, people would do comedy as a character, like people really didn't do here. And so that was still kind of going on. But when I started there, it was sort of just shifting where it had kind of looked back to the US and they had started really picking up on the sort of one-liner Mitch Hedberg, Stephen Wright kind of one-liner, that sort of like second wave surreal one-liner, kind of impersonal one-liner stuff. So that was kind of going on there. So it was always sort of out of phase for, I think, for better than it was here. Now they've sort of caught up because like the world's so much smaller and people could consume things from everywhere. But it was definitely, you know, there's a guy named Stuart Lee who is one of the best stand-ups I've ever seen in my life. And I've never seen anyone do what he does, where he does these really fascinating long form jokes where he'll be talking for half an hour and you'll have enjoyed the whole thing. But at the 29 minute mark will be the punchline from the joke he started at minute one that you forgot he even started. And it's like a magic trick. It's just like amazing. It's like this crescendo of like, and thank you. And I've never seen anyone do that kind of stuff. So that really made me have to sort of examine those things more because it was new to me.
Yeah. And you got to find your way to do it.
Yeah. Because it's like, why else would people want to go see you of all people go and talk? Like, what is it about you that I'm going to sit here and listen to, you know?
I once saw really super early George Carlin when he wore a suit.
Oh, yeah.
And he was clean shaven. And
yeah,
he was,
yeah. He just feels like he needs to take a shit.
Oh, yeah. It was just like.
Bound up, man. It ain't him.
It's going to crack.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's, hey, not everybody figures that out about, not everyone has that in them, but those that have them in them, sometimes it's a moving target. It's not necessarily one thing that you can nail down. And look, there's a reason why people turn to comedy. It's because you're miserable motherfuckers.
Oh, yeah. No, it's people, it's a coping mechanism, you know. Yeah, it's a detachment. Yeah. It's a gallows humor. And you know, anyone who listens to my show is going to laugh when I bring this up, because I bring it up all the time, and I might even brought it up when we were talking, but Stephen King's Dance Macabre, did I bring that up when we were talking? His nonfiction book about horror fiction.
I don't think so, but it's, go for it.
This book is like a Rosetta Stone to me. It's Stephen King was teaching in Maine in the late 70s. He was teaching a horror fiction class. He basically took his syllabus and his notes. He wrote it into this book called Dance Macabre. It was his first nonfiction book. And it's about how horror works. And it's brilliant. But it's also really easy to read, autobiographical. He talks about the movie Tourist Trap. Like, it's just amazing. And I recommend it to people who do comedy, because I'm like, look, horror and comedy, same exact structure, different payoff, exactly the same. No difference at all. Context, character, like they all get the reaction. And it's the book where he talks about the clown at midnight thing, where he's like, you know, and I know people are scared of clowns, so it's, the metaphor is a little bit different, but he's like, you know, a clown at the circus, funny, clown in the front of your lawn at midnight is scary. But the inverse is true, where it's, you know, Michael Myers on your lawn at midnight is scary, but he's in the circus and people are putting pies in his face and seltzer. It's funny, right? So it's the same kind of thing. And I think people sort of drawn to both of those things. It's the catharsis. It's also the, you know, at least in horror, I feel like it's the control aspect of, you know, there's rules around the chaos and the terrible things. There's a conclusion. There's a way to get out of it, even if they don't. Whereas, you know, in their life, they may not see that.
In our experience, Gil and I just started attending horror conventions, and it's been a fascinating experience. One of the first things that we observed, there's the cosplay. Sure. Which is remarkable, and the makeup special effects are as good as anything we do. They dress up as Michael Myers, as Freddy. They dress up as Leatherface. You know who they never dress up as? None of them. The victims.
No, ever.
Because, first of all, the monster, and not all monsters are villain, but the monster has all the fun, but most importantly, all the power.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we kind of got was that of horror is because as they walk around, they're completely empowered, and they're the sweetest people. And it's not like they walk around dressed like that looking to hurt anybody. They're
right.
walk around sweet as can be. Every horrible instinct they have has been sublimated into this.
Yeah.
It is absolutely therapeutic in the healthiest way possible. It is, yeah, you walk away from a horror convention, first of all, blown away by everyone's imagination, but really how sweet and genuine pretty much everybody there is.
Yeah, it's that shared experience as well, like the bonding over that, like a fake trauma, right? It's like trauma bonding over, like, we all experienced this sort of trauma that actually was more like a roller coaster, but now we can kind of all feel like we have that in common, which I think is why the, you know, that fandom sort of pop up around horror. Horror was kind of the first thing that started having its own conventions, really, like fandom conventions, at least.
It was the Trekkies.
Yeah, and Fangoria started Weekend of Horrors around the same
time.
But I think really, I think the Trekkies were pretty close to the first.
Yeah.
When they began throwing just small get-togethers, then they became larger get-togethers. And somewhere between the two, these were two groups. These were always the square pegs, unable to get to. So they're not going to get any goddamn round holes.
Right.
The horror community and the sci-fi community, geeks and just never the cool kids.
No, and it's possibility too. Like, the reason I never got into Star Trek is the very reason that was probably the first giant fan community, because it's a utopian future, which we never see in sci-fi. It's always dystopia, but it's a utopian future, which I think a lot of people find, you know, very comforting. And you know, and Comic-Cons were around, but they were mostly driven by commerce. Like, you couldn't buy back issues, you couldn't buy comics, there wasn't a local comic shop, so those had obviously have a fan component, but there was like a practical reason they would have those. Whereas the fan conventions for horror and sci-fi were like, we're getting together to like meet people like us and, you know, talk about this stuff and see the people from the thing.
Were you a fan of horror?
Yes, huge, massive horror fan.
What was your biggest horror?
Romero, Dawn of the Dead is still like a touchstone movie for me. And like, the older I get, the more brilliant that movie is. And it, like, especially during the pandemic, it hit me so hard. You know, like there's a scene in the opening of that where it's in the TV station, and, you know, the shit's hitting the fan, and they're trying to put rescue stations and all this stuff. And I remember growing up, there's a line where the news reader goes, you know, despite everything that's going on, some people still have a sense of humor. And growing up, and so they throw to some dumb, you know, human interest story. And as a kid, I was like, that rings so false. Like, that's so stupid. But then during COVID, I was like, that's exactly what we're doing. They're normalizing this horrific thing, like trying to treat it like it's every day. And that's what is the downfall. Like, when people can't let go of, you know, old ways and silly beliefs to sort of work together to get past whatever the thing is. Like, the thing I always say with Romero movies is, it could have been, you know, bunny rabbits. It didn't matter that it was zombies, although there's a different element there because it's, you're looking at us and all that kind of stuff. But it's every single time it's the regular humans who end up screwing each other over, and their greed and you know, stubbornness is what leads to everybody's downfall. And I'm like, these are very basic lessons. Like, during COVID, I would just be like, didn't you guys see Romero movies? What's wrong with you people? We need to work together here.
Going back to comedy, does everybody have a sense of humor?
I think so. But I think that some people have a streak of cruelty that they think is their sense of humor. And those are the people who are just like, well, I'm kind of on PC, it's a little bit dark. And I'm like, oh no, you're just an asshole. Like, you're not funny. But so in that regard, sort of, it's on the spectrum of humor, I think.
I wonder about people who cannot laugh at themselves, because there are lots and lots of people who I wonder if they have a sense of humor at all.
I always wonder if those people that take themselves incredibly seriously just had really good childhoods.
You're awfully forgiving.
They didn't need to have a sense of humor.
I look at someone like Donald Trump and I think, The one thing
he thinks he's hilarious, though. That's the thing. Like, but he bullies, thinks he's doing jokes.
But bullies often do. But
oh, yes.
But if you turned it on him, there was a very famous incident at the White House Correspondents' Dinner when Obama was still president, and he started doing a couple of jokes about Trump. And the cameras went to Trump in the audience. And man, if you could read his thoughts, if he had any, it would have yeah. been, because he's an inarticulate boob anyway. So it would have been, you know, monosyllabic grunts, but it would have been hilarious just to read those grunts happening in his head. Because I think that was perhaps the moment when he was going to start off to do what he did.
Yeah, to run out of spite. A friend of mine wrote those jokes and has literally felt like guilt about it. Like they're the person that really? Broke the world.
I think part of the problem is that Trump, well, I would say he has no sense of humor.
No.
Because to me, a bully laughing at other people, well, that's not actually humor. That's actually bullying, because you're using the joke as a cudgel really to hurt them. You're really, comedy is laughing with. It's a communal thing. And if
it's a comforter.
And if you begin to laugh at it, the whole thing has turned into something else. So it's, When I grew up a Groucho Marx fan, and the first couple of years that I was a Marx Brother fan, I saw them on TV. I only ever saw them by myself, laughing by myself. I knew they were funny. It wasn't until I was in college and they would screen Marx Brother movies in front of an audience, and I saw it with an audience, that I understood just how funny they were. It's a strange thing about comedy.
Yeah.
And how it plays, even when you know it's funny, it's a communal thing.
It requires seeing how people react to it other than yourself, which is a weird emotion that I can't think of anything else like that, where if you see a sad movie, it's sad. Like, you don't need an audience to tell you or how sad it is. Like, people aren't crying in the seats. But with a comedy, it's sort of has that different element.
And especially where self-deprecation is involved, that's really a key component of most comedy. Hey, even a Don Rickles, who, an insult comic, but there was something about him and his delivery where you knew it was okay, because he would make jokes about himself.
Of course. Although Bobcat told me that he learned Rickles' line he wouldn't cross was on the Tales episode they did. Have you heard this?
No. Please tell.
So it's, for people who haven't seen it, it's a ventriloquist act, and Don Rickles, the surprises, is,
and he's called the ventriloquist dummy.
Yeah,
I think is
what it's called. It's his parasitic twin brother is actually his hand. So in the scene where he's like cutting his hand off, I forgot who directed it, but they were like, you know, you're in pain, like, you know, you gotta scream like fuck or something like that. And Rickles was like, I don't curse. And he was like, and Bobcat was like, what, you say the worst things about people, like the meanest, worst jokes about people. He's like, yeah, but I never curse. Like, he would not swear, wouldn't do it. That was, he's like, I have a family act, like, refused.
I don't work blue.
Right.
Wow. Well, hey, but you know, he knew his brand.
Yeah.
You can't take that away from him.
Yeah, but even his stuff, to your point, yeah, like the stuff where it'd be like, Ma, the check's coming. Like, that kind of stuff was very self-deprecating. Like,
but that's what makes it play. If he doesn't do that, then everything takes on a rather a much darker timbre.
Yeah, it becomes very sinister.
Yeah. The thing about a Donald Trump, you know, I happened to catch his SNL hosting gig.
Painful.
Really, what were you all thinking? What were you all thinking? And he doesn't realize really when he's the butt of a joke.
No.
In his mind, that's not a possibility. They were able to, you know, he's amusing in spots, but it's hard to watch because he has no sense of humor.
No. And he doesn't, the jokes he's delivering that aren't, he's not the butt of, you can tell he does not understand.
Right.
Yes. And so I really do think there are people walking around who honestly, it's like people who are colorblind. They don't have the mechanism inside their rods and cones to see certain colors.
Well, those people, not the colorblind, but the humorless people also probably are soulless.
Well, but I think that you make a great point, because really, if you don't see the irony, and I think that's another thing that a Donald Trump simply can't see. He certainly cannot see the irony of virtually every word that tumbles from his head. Because
you have to see reality as well. Like, he has that, like, writ large Tony Robbins The Secret garbage of, like, I'll just lie until reality is shaped to what I want it to be around me. And if you're doing that, you got to commit full on, and you can't acknowledge that things aren't that. And if you're not acknowledging reality, you can't do humor.
Oh, picky, 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 you guys. You want reality too? Jesus Christ. Isn't comedy hard enough without reality?
But really and truly, the best comedy is the most real, that has the most grit, that strikes the truest inside each and every one of us. That's what it's the recognition of of the inner truths. That's really what you're going for.
It requires empathy.
Yeah, that's why Curb Your Enthusiasm has such a following, because we see ourselves in there and we see people we know in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. What got you into the podcasting? What suddenly, because you've now been doing this, you first started podcasting. The first episode of your TV guidance counselor was February 14th, 2014. On Gil's birthday. Was that by design?
Thank you for celebrating my birthday that way. I really appreciate that.
That was my inspiration. I said, you know who would like this? I always kind of wanted to have a podcast. I really enjoy, I worked in radio when I was in college, and I always loved long form interviews, and I loved Dick Cavett. Love Dick Cavett. Going back in hindsight, rewatching a lot of them, less for Dick Cavett and more for the format. Like, there's some amazing episodes. Like, there's a four-parter he does with Robert Mitchum that's like one of my I love Robert Mitchum. He's like my favorite everything. And so that interested me.
But back then, look, nowadays we all know what podcasting is. It's a kind of Wild West where really you can do whatever the hell you want. Hey, you might not get an audience, but that's neither here nor there. That's up to you to find an audience.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful, it's the Napsterization of the last final piece of showbiz, where really anyone can now do a show, literally. But it's a wonderful, wonderful thing, because actually it's just made storytelling accessible to more and more people. And it's amazing, what's out there.
The bar for entry is so much lower. Like, it ended up being sort of the perfect storm of my interests, because technology got cheaper, where with a very low investment of like $100, I basically had what it took $2 million studios at the radio station that I used to work at to do. And my computer, virtually, I was right on the shelf in the virtual store next to things that do cost $1 million without costing $1 million. So the sort of DIY punk rock world, where we were putting out our own records, we were distributing our own things, we were doing our own tours, making the phone calls, like, it's sort of the great utopia of that made real. So that all appealed to me. And as much as I like doing stand-up, I hated everything else about it. And I still do stand-up, and I still like the actual stand-up, but I hate like the socializing and a lot of the people who hang out there. And and I never did like, there are people who, I always kept a day job because I'm terrified of being poor again, but B, it meant I could say no to things. So many of my friends are like, I got to go do this guy's retirement party, and his wife wants me to write jokes about his hernia, like that kind of stuff, where I'm like, no, like, you've made it work now. And it's the creative outlet. I don't want it to be work. So I was always looking for other ways to do stuff. And I had been doing every year I would do a long form show for like 5 years. I did like an hour long show. So 1 year I did one called Very Special Episode that was sort of about television history and very special episodes, but was also sort of stories from my life and how they intertwine with television stuff. And I did one on music and a couple other things too, but that one sort of was the seed for this. And I always had TV guides. Like I literally worked and paid for my own subscription as a kid. I used to deal comic books as a kid. I would buy comic collections and take the stuff I wanted and flip the, you know, the stuff that was valuable.
What was it about TV Guide that touched your soul?
Two things, really. One, it's really well written. Like the articles are great. Like Isaac Asimov wrote for it. You had Eleanor Roosevelt. Like, you know, there's an article about The Prisoner that Ray Bradbury's writing in there, you know, like amazing writing in that. The other thing was, you know, as a movie fan, we didn't have IMDb, so they always had that movie glossary, which was like year, director, stars, like you could look movies up, and that was a novelty. And because I couldn't watch everything at once, I would literally read the TV guide from cover to cover, and I'm like, well, it's kind of like watching everything. So I read about all the shows that were on if I couldn't watch them. And as a kid who grew up in a pretty chaotic environment, it was consistent. So every Wednesday that came in the mail, and if TV Guide said that show was on Thursday night at 8, God damn it, that was on Thursday night at 8. And it was something to look forward to, and it was like a level of consistency. So, it, you know, it was always really important to me. And that was
like a day planner.
Yeah, exactly. And there were a lot of things where I'd be like, well, if I can get through X, Y, and Z this week, then I can watch this, or, you know, I can watch Saturday Night Live. I'll make it, you know, it's Saturday cartoons. It's Tales of the Crypt. And so that was really important to me. So I had them all, and I had a spinning rack of them in my dining room, like in the corner, like that I had bought at a flea market. And I wanted to do a podcast, but I didn't want it to be like comics talking about comedy. Cause those are so, to me, those were like eavesdropping in people at a restaurant where you're like, that's an interesting conversation. It would probably be really interesting if those were my friends. Like it's sort of not quite there. And if people would come over to my house, inevitably they would go to the TV guides, and people would just, if we're just hanging around, they'd flip through them and be like, I forgot about this show. Remember this thing. And so another comic friend of mine, Sean Sullivan, very funny. He was like, that, just do that as a podcast. Just someone takes the TV guide and talk about it. Like the, and that's really what it is. I mean, we don't always use it, but it's kind of from day one to now been exactly the same. And I'm also like a creature of habit. And so, I haven't missed a week. I'm like 700 episodes in or something.
Yeah.
Like that.
That is amazing. I'm trying, we're trying here. It's really challenging.
Lives, so
you know, I think we might be at 100 episodes now. Over 3 seasons. I think I'll have to, my math is not my strong suit.
Which is amazing. Like, can you imagine? Like, you know, you've worked and work in television and movies, making 100 episodes of anything.
Right.
This one of the things that I love about podcasting and is outputting a piece of finished work every single week.
Mm-hmm.
And for that alone is to me reason enough to do it. I love the rigor. I love the demands of it. It's been a while since I've produced a TV show. I spent 2 decades losing
like
my mind.
Riding a bike.
but what I especially missed is the intense deadline pressure. You know, mm-hmm. that ideally if you're doing a series, you're prepping one, you're shooting one, you're posting one, and you're probably writing another one as well. So Jesus, the deadline, there's no moment when you're not under intense pressure. Love that. That's a wonderful creative environment to me, because I got so many things happening in my head.
I 100% get that. Yeah, and it kind of taps into what we're talking about with the fandoms and conventions, where it's the same sort of thing where, you know, growing up, like your friend group would be like your parents' friends' kids, just because it was based on proximity rather than shared interest, right? And then like the friends you met make in college and later in life tend to be better friends because it's based on shared experiences and shared interests. We can kind of shortcut right to shared interest with this kind of stuff, where, you know, I always tell people, like, do the most niche podcast possible, like the weird thing you think no one else is into and you want to talk about the minutia of it forever. That's the thing that's going to get you a bunch of listeners, because there's a bunch of people like you who want to hear that thing. And that I've never encountered that in media, where that's been that's the complete antithesis of every single, you know, media executive, where they're like, we gotta appeal to more people. So like, no, do a show about the history of shoelaces or whatever.
The depth into which your conversations go, your podcast, I mean, even if you just read through the TV guide like descriptions of what you all talk about, wow, it is a cornucopia of everything.
Well, yeah, we could go on all the tangents, and then it gives us a snapshot of a week in history, because something that was designed to be thrown away ends up being the best possible snapshot of a time and place. But the other thing about television, you know, aside from movies, where movies are an event, you go out and you experience them on their own terms. TV is very personal. It's weekly. It's in their environment. So it ends up being the soundtrack and part of their life experiences. So, you know, inevitably when we're talking about these shows, stuff about growing up comes up, or, you know, memories they'd forgotten about, or this kind of thing. So they're sort of all intrinsically linked in there. And that is a really interesting aspect to me as well.
TV is a very different experience as entertainment, but also to create for it, because you're going to be in their home. 65 was the magic number, because I was 13 times 5.
Yeah, you were right, thinking, okay. 45, because we mentioned Trump.
Yes, I got stuck on that motherfucker. Yeah, so 65, so you know, and they, because they were going to be people are not going to necessarily watch them in sequence. You couldn't do a story that ran consequentially. You couldn't. So it had to be 45 variations on a theme that had a bunch of characters that people would want to have in their home on a weekly basis. And so even the way that you came up with a TV show was so, oh man, it was so hard. It was, that's why we're experiencing a golden age now, because the
compared to now. And compared to now?
I think yes and no. I think to a degree, like, yes, I think there's great stuff now. But at the same time, I'll watch a series on Netflix and I'm like, this was a movie script that they made into 8 episodes of a TV show. Or because that's the model. Whereas,
yes, true.
I don't know which one's better, but I'm like, sometimes within those rules, you come up with creative, you know, it's easy to make garbage like that, but the people who crack it and within the rules manage to do something amazing, it's way more, like, the level is higher.
Yeah.
As with every format, there are going to be people who know how to do it right. And a lot of people who they sort of get, but not really.
Yeah. They get the mechanics and they can just kind of plug in play, you know?
I always think back to when the movie Big opened. There were two other movies that opened really at about the same time with the exact same story idea. A little boy becomes a man.
Yep, like father, like son, and vice versa.
Right, right, right. And the other two flopped, but Big got it right because of how it told the story, because it went inside. It didn't just play the joke. It went for the character.
And there was no flip side character. That's the other thing, where we didn't see an adult acting like a child.
Right.
We saw it, which is always off-putting, I think. Because even as a kid, I remember watching those movies and like, I was like, Judge Reinhold's acting like a baby. He's supposed to be 9. You know? Which, yeah, an adult would write it that way. But as like a 10-year-old, I'm like, come on.
As with all jokes, there are ways to tell it and a lot of ways not to.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's the name of the podcast?
TV Guidance Counselor. It's on all the podcast apps, and you can go to tvguidancecounselor.com, and I have all the links there. Like, as a kid who grew up, like, I just feel like some idiot from Boston, you know, and I watched like all these shows and they were like a great escape for me and, you know, expanded my mind and all this stuff. And the fact that I've been able to, you know, talk to guys like you who made things that were so important to me growing up, and have these people on my show and discuss those things. And also, you know, what came in with stuff like that is mind boggling to me. And a lot of the time I jokingly say a lot of the people I have on my show are people I wanted to read a biography of, but they didn't write one. So I was just like, I'll go get it.
Have you ever tried writing for television or for motion picture?
I have. I was pitching shows for a while before the pandemic, and I pitched 27 shows. And one of them I wrote like 13 episodes of. And I liked it, but I was way out of phase for what stuff they were looking for. Mm-hmm. I pulled one show completely out of my ass in the room that I ended up actually liking the most. And I think I don't know what I'm going to do with it, but I started revisiting it. But I was pitching stuff at IFC, and they were like, Documentary Now is our favorite show that we have on. Do you have anything like that? And I was like, sure, I do. And I was like, it's a Quantum Leap Video Store. And they were like, what? I'm like, it's called 3-Day Rental. It's in the future, and you can rent someone's life for 3 days. So it's kind of an anthology. And it was this whole thing. And they were like, oh, like, so I wrote it all up, and they were like, it's too much like Documentary Now. But since then, I've kind of reworked it, and I kind of like the idea of it, and I've been focusing more on like the future thing. But yeah, I've always wrote scripts and stuff.
That's a really cool idea.
Oh, thank you. I was like, this is fun. And it was funny because that's the one I was like, yeah, that thing. Because they were all looking for more like, we want a show about a comedian who goes and does comedy and his life is crazy and he's dating, that kind of stuff, which, you know.
Please be a one trick pony.
Right. But that, you know, I mean, you guys know better than anyone that executives go, we saw a thing that did well. Can you do that? we don't want to take a chance on anything.
Yes. Can you exactly duplicate the thing you did before?
Yes. Just
with different names.
And if it doesn't make money, we'll tell you it's your fault. It's too much like the thing you did before.
Look what they're ordering. I mean, they're all ordering that. Now I just read somewhere they're going to do another Blair Witch.
Yeah.
And they're going to do
recognition.
All of the old movies are coming back.
We know people know this name, so we'll save money on advertising or something, you know. I wrote a script once about, I was trying to think of monsters that we haven't exploited in the West. And one of my favorite monsters are Chinese hopping vampires, which I don't know if you're familiar with that. They're a traditional Chinese monster that are, you know, they have all these amazing weird rules, and there's a bunch of Chinese movies. So I wrote this script about these two recovering heroin addicts in Boston who aren't the brightest guys. They're like Southie kind of guys. And they're like, we got to stop the heroin because it's hurting everybody. So they read about opium and all this stuff. So they get this idea in their head that it's coming out of Chinatown, and they start following this old guy. And through a series of events, this guy has a bunch of these vampires. He's a Taoist priest, and he's like keeping them in one of the, and they release them. So now these idiots have to go try and save, you know, round them up with all this stuff. And I remember the note I got was like, well, you're making fun of heroin addicts here. And I'm like, no, I'm not. It's like good intentioned idiots who knew a little bit enough to be dangerous now have to do, like, that's the interesting part to me.
Yeah.
And it gets frustrating where people are like, you know, they latch onto like a weird part of the thing that you did.
Well, yes, people who are not going, executives who are not going to get it are not going to get it. And really, their notice, the exact detail that they're latching on, is quite irrelevant.
Yeah,
they're just
something
grabbing
like
onto something.
With. Yeah, I know, just named the character Dave, and I had a guy named Dave growing up I didn't like, so I don't know, I can't see it.
It's not for me. It works perfectly fine. You don't get it. That's okay.
Yeah,
it's, you know, that's why, as my dad used to say, they make chocolate and vanilla and strawberry.
Yes, My grandfather, side note, used to buy the Neapolitan ice cream cartons. You know, it's the three.
Yeah.
It was cheapest, and he didn't like strawberries. So in the freezer were just like 10 only strawberry left cartons of ice cream at any given time.
Oh, that's so funny.
You know something? I had the same Cosmopolitan thing, only the chocolate was missing.
Yeah. You just got to find another person who likes the vanilla, and you'll save so much money.
Right. Right.
There's a relationship to be had there. This has been such a pleasure having the second conversation with you. I'm so glad you could join us for this. I cannot recommend highly enough Ken's his podcast. TV Guidance Counselor is just it's a terrific podcast. It's
thank you so much.
And I'd like to say something. I'd like to see you start writing again and start seeing some of that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I should. I really have to. It's I got really disheartened post pandemic, and I need to kind of revisit some of that stuff because yeah. I'm far enough away from it that I'm like, oh, maybe that wasn't so bad.
You need a couple of pushy friends
who
won't let you just sit there not doing it.
That is 100% true.
So I think it's going to be our mission to continue to nudge you, Ken, because
we
you're incredibly talented, and we're also going to link to a couple of your stand-up bits. Because
oh, thank you.
The one about the neighbor across the street, Eddie Murphy, is fucking hilarious. What a great story. Wow.
I had someone email me and ask if they could. They were writing doing a book of stories to teach people how to speak. I think it was Czechoslovakian, and they asked if they could include it translated. So somewhere I have it translated.
In the Czechoslovakian?
Yeah, and I'm like, I didn't know how to say that. All right.
Sounds like an evening of theater.
Yes, exactly.
Thank you so much again, Ken, and thank you, everyone, as always, for listening. We will see you next time. The How Not to Make a Movie podcast is executive produced by me, Alan Katz, by Gil Adler, and by Jason Stein. Our artwork was done by the amazing Jody Webster, and Jason Jody, along with Mando, are all the hosts of the fun and informative Dads from the Crypt podcast. Follow them for what my old pal the Crypt Keeper would have called terrific Crypt content.